Illinois Appellate Court Third Division is now in session. The Honorable Justice Margaret S. McBride is presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and please be seated.
People v. Schatzbottom.
If all the attorneys, or the attorneys that are going to present oral argument, would you step up to the podium and identify yourselves for the record?
My name is Warrington Parker. I'm appearing on behalf of Schatzbottom.
Mr. Parker.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. And?
Good morning. I am Assistant Public Defender Celeste Adaman, arguing on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Merritt Jones.
Adaman? Ms. Adaman?
Adaman.
Good morning, Ms. Adaman.
Thank you.
All right. And we have?
Jonathan Beyer, Assistant State's Attorney, Supervisor of Civil Appeals for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office.
All right.
For the people.
So you've weighed in.
We've weighed in, and we'll defer to any questions of the court. We can rest on our brief if that simplifies matters.
All right.
If you have questions, I'm glad to answer, but otherwise.
Okay. Well, that's I think we can take your position from your brief. So that will then leave us with Mr. Parker and Ms. Adaman. Each of you will have about 15 minutes to present oral arguments. And from that, Mr. Parker, you may save some time out for rebuttal. All right?
Very good. All set?
Yes.
Did you want to say a specific amount of time for rebuttal?
5 minutes. I was going to. That's what I was asking. If I could ask that question.
I had a feeling that was your question. And because of the issues, we're suggesting that you kind of focus on that as opposed to the jurisdictional argument that the public defender has raised.
Well, I think I beat that argument, so I won't raise it.
All right. Well, either way.
We love your confidence, Mr. Kerner.
All right. You may proceed then.
May it please the court. My name is Warrington Parker, representing Schatzbottom. I think I'd like to table set to begin with on 3 points. The first is Schatzbottom has provided information in response to the subpoena. There were 41,
Mr.
42.
Mr. Parker, if I could cut you off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we even get to the issue.
Yes, ma'am.
You've contended that the standard of review is de novo.
I did.
So I'm looking all over for this. It's constitutional or privilege. Where are you getting it's de novo?
Oh, from the case cited, and it's actually not disputed. And so I would just base it on the case.
It is very much disputed, Mr. Barker. So I would not skip right over that one.
I'm sorry. Let me say something different. I understand the court is disputing that. And I don't mind if the court applies a different standard of review.
Oh, but you're saying that the public defender has agreed to your standard of review?
They did not dispute it in their brief.
Okay,
that's all I'm saying. I understand the court has an issue with it.
Okay.
Right. And so I will just have to rely on the case for the de novo standard that we cited. And we did say that if the court disagrees with that, then a different standard of review applies. But the underlying facts are not in dispute in terms of what is requested, what the status of the case is. Those are not in dispute. We're disputing the court's decision based on those facts.
Okay.
And that's why we set the de novo standard.
Well, what about the Supreme Court case that we think is really contrary to your position?
If the court disagrees, I'm more than happy to rely on the different standard of review. I don't want to fight about this overly much.
All right. Okay. Well, then, proceed.
Thank you. So as in all the cases in which Schatzbottom receives a subpoena, and here, Schatzbottom does provide information. And Schatzbottom here provided, it's not in the record, but it's 243 pages of documents and audio files. Schatzbottom provided information about the sensors that were relevant, that were alerted here. Schatzbottom provided the studies that were requested. Schatzbottom provided the audio files so that if anyone wanted to contend that it's not gunfire, they can actually bring someone in and do that. What we're objecting to is the court's finding that if the state makes Schatzbottom relevant, then this additional discovery would thereby be relevant.
Well, what does it have to do with if the state, this is a defense case, defender's office is representing Merritt Jones.
Correct.
They are contesting their ability to defend their clients on criminal charges that arise out of an arrest report that says that the police responded to a gunshot at a given location. So this isn't really about what the state's going to do.
Understood.
This is about the defense of a criminal case. So with that in mind, I think you should address it.
And so the Nixon standard requires that something be material and evidentiary. And right
isn't
now,
it evidentiary and relevant?
Not yet, because first...
Well, what does Nixon say? Give us the first factor. Now you're it's saying evidence, it's materiality?
Material and evidentiary.
Okay.
Right? And there is currently nothing on file to which this ShotSpotter alert is relevant. In fact, at least before
okay,
the
so
court,
again,
Whoa. Let's go back.
Yeah. Wait. The standard in the wording of Nixon is not what you said.
It's...
Material sought is evidentiary and relevant. Go ahead, Justice.
Right.
Okay. So we have no testimony, correct? We have no testimony. We just have the positions of the attorneys below.
Correct.
Okay. But we do have the arrest report. And in the arrest report, it states no less than three times that they were stopped pursuant to the ShotSpotter alert, that the officers pursuant to that ShotSpotter alert curbed the vehicle, and that pursuant to that ShotSpotter alert, the officers did an investigation.
I agree.
Okay. So the... They do say that the defendant drove away from them, drove eastbound into Garfield Park.
I agree.
But no less than three times have they mentioned ShotSpotter being the basis for the stop.
I agree.
So I'm not sure how we're getting that it's not going to be relevant what the basis of that stop was.
Because I don't know that state is going to what the state is going to
It doesn't matter.
But if they bring a motion to suppress...
Okay, so the state could say we're going to rely on the fact that Joe Blow said that this guy had a gun in his car.
Yes.
But if the arrest reports are giving different indication, the defense can rely on that. So it's irrelevant what the state could or might argue.
I'm not disputing that. Right now, though, this defendant has not even indicated that they're going to file a motion to suppress.
Well, do you expect them to wait for months to determine what their strategy is? The charge is pending. And it's obvious that the defense subpoenaed ShotSpotter, not the state's attorney's office. So the interests here have nothing to do with the state at this point. The question is this information relevant to the defense when their client was stopped allegedly because of a gunshot? That's the issue. They're the ones seeking the information, not the state. I don't think you've cited a single case that has anything to do with whether the state decides this is they're going to use this information. What case are you relying on?
I think let me back up.
Sure.
First, let me just say a few things. First, it is when I say it's not relevant right now, there is nothing pending to which it is relevant. I understand.
Well, but I guess you don't understand that this is a criminal trial.
I do.
The case is entitled People of the State of Illinois versus Merritt Jones. Merritt Jones has been charged with six counts of aggravated driving under the influence of alcohol. He's been appointed a public defender to represent him. The public defender's interest in defending their client arises out of the Sixth Amendment. They want to be able to defend their client. They have a good basis right now for seeking material that's relevant to their defense. The defense in this case is going to be, I don't think there's any question, that the arrest was lacking probable cause and or there was no basis for a Terry stop. So the question is, just wait, how can you possibly say that the arrest circumstances are not relevant and how those circumstances arose are directly related to the officer's statement in a report three times that we responded to a call of a gunshot. That where they stopped wasn't even actually the location.
But let me try it a different way then.
Sure.
I'm certainly saying the circumstances of his arrest are relevant.
Sure.
What I am saying is that discovery ordered in connection with this is not relevant. That's what I'm really saying. That's why I started by saying we have actually produced information pursuant to subpoena without challenge, without seeking a motion to quash.
But the trial court did go through the subpoena requests and did make determinations of what would be relevant, and they narrowed the scope of all of the subpoenas.
Yes and no, let me give an example. There's, we call them 7.1, 7.5, for example. That asks for all protocols, procedures, and similar documents since, from the very beginning, 1996 and for every city. It was not limited in any way, shape, or
form. Did the court limit it in the ruling?
No. Another one is the court asked for all...
I thought it was asking, or maybe I'm misremembering this, that it was limited to the protocols that were in place for the people at the time that the ShotSpotter alert came in. What relevance would 25 years ago have?
I don't know. It's 845C211. Request 7.1, 7.2, 7.3, and 7.4. ShotSpotter's motion to quash these requests are denied.
Okay. So you're saying it's going back 25 years?
That's how I read it.
Okay.
I would love not to. I mean, I would love not to.
Well, that's probably something that you and counsel could have worked out quite easily. So, but I think counsel, I think defense counsel will disagree with you that the court's order suggested 25 years worth of policies and procedures.
If that's true, I will stand to be corrected. But I'm just saying that's what how I read the order.
Okay.
The next that I would say is they would like the court, it's under the two series, which is all disagreements back and forth between ShotSpotter and the algorithm. The court limited that to 3 months before November 7th and 3 months after November 7th. That's for the entire city of Chicago. The issue with that is there are thousands and thousands of alerts in that period of time, and people don't disagree. The individual makes the decision. There's not a disagreement between the algorithm and the people. It's just so in other words, that doesn't tend to show one way or another about this particular arrest. And the information about this particular arrest has been produced. And I keep coming back to it because I think the court somehow thinks...
So you think that the reliability of any other than this one incident is the only thing that's relevant for the defense in this case?
Currently, I do believe that.
Okay, and what if you're wrong about that?
If
there isn't any exploration about other incidents and their reliability, I mean, why wouldn't that be relevant?
And as I said, the court will, of course, disagree as it wishes. There are courts that rely, the Second Circuit, for example.
And what case are you relying on for that?
Yes.
There are three cases. There's circuits that say that this system isn't reliable, and then there's circuits that say it is. And then we have those cases that you cited where actual police officers testify.
That's correct.
We don't have that here. We're not even at that point.
And I have no control over that at all.
No, this is pre-trial.
And those are the cases I was going to cite to this court. They're page 25 and 26 of our brief, where courts have allowed officers to testify about the reliability.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the reason also all of the other materials sought are not relevant.
And how do you know? How do you know standing before this court that there's a single police officer in Chicago that could testify about the reliability?
And if not, then that's a whole new thing.
But this is pre-trial.
Right.
I mean, you're expecting this to go through some process where they're going to wait and see, and you're going to wait and see, and we're going to wait and see if there are police officers in the city that can say, well, I responded to 500 calls or 50 calls, and I'm familiar with this particular area, and every gunshot alert that we got was accurate. I mean, we don't know any of this.
As a third party, I think I'm entitled to make that request under the Nixon standard, to be perfectly frank.
I don't think so, because you don't have anything that suggests right now there's anyone within the Chicago Police Department that can in any way testify to the reliability of this system.
That's between the state and the defendant at this point.
No, it actually is between the defense and your company right now. They were subpoenaed, not the state.
I understand, but I'm saying the court's going to likely disagree with me.
Well, we don't know.
If I were in the position of a non-third party, I would say to this court, you're right, this is going to be a hard one for me to win. But I'm a third party. If the defendant and the
third party is providing the information that is at the heart of the subpoena.
At the heart of the subpoena, correct. I don't even know if it's at the heart of
the
subpoena.
The appeal.
I agree with that, too. Yes, I agree with that. But whether it's at the heart of the case, this is precisely why... All we're asking is for exactly what the court is wondering about, which is there somebody who can do this? I don't know. And if there isn't, that's a reason to come and come back and say this needs to be tested for liability.
Okay, now let me ask you this.
Yes.
It's apparent from reading this record and these briefs that at some point the defense is going to want to test the reliability of your process. And I didn't read a single case that you cited where someone has actually testified about the reliability of this system.
I understand. And
normally it would be your company that would provide that information. The police department can't testify at all about this. And even though you suggest that that's where this belongs, how could you possibly suggest to this court that ShotSpotter, or rather the police department, should be the ones that supply the reliability of your company?
I see what you're saying. So I want to, then let me make sure I don't over. For reasonable suspicion and probable cause, that's the only thing that those cases at page 25 and 26 go to. ShotSpotter has always provided a witness to testify about its reliability. And that would do so in this case as well.
But why aren't there any cases that actually suggest that?
Because we didn't cite to the underlying court that there, ShotSpotter survived 20 Daubert and Kelly Fry hearings. It has never been found to be unreliable by any court.
Okay,
it's
so
just
what,
not
about
under
the, what about the,
has that Fry hearing ever gone in Illinois?
No. It's been in California, Missouri, New York, and New Jersey. I believe those are the cases.
And did all those other states have reports from the Office of their Inspector Generals that indicated that the reliability is 9% or thereabouts?
No, and that's actually, the Inspector General just cannot place that. If you read the last paragraph, says we can't place this. They don't have the information to say that this is directly tied to ShotSpotter.
Okay.
Mr. Parker, could we turn to the reclassification notes one more time?
Yes.
So it's 3 months prior to the incident and 3 months post-incident.
Correct.
Does ShotSpotter have the ability to collect that information?
Yes.
Okay. With regard to the calibration logs, I'm assuming they keep them?
I'm assuming so, too.
Okay. So they have the ability to tend to that as well?
Yes.
They do have policies and procedures that are in place for all of the review of the audio files. Is that correct?
Yes.
And those policies and procedures, I assume, are updated at certain...
I don't know the answer to that, but...
But we can assume that at any given point in time, there's a policy and a protocol that's involved. And are there any Chicago-specific validation studies?
No. But all studies that we have been produced.
Okay. Thank you.
Did the court, the trial court here, did she limit the information that was going to, that she ordered to be provided to the attorneys of the case only and no others?
I actually don't remember that. We did have a request for a protective order,
and
I believe that was entered.
Yeah, I believe it was too, but you're not sure.
Since that wasn't one of the things I focused on in this argument, I can only say I believe so. I can't say more than that. But I believe there is a protective order.
So all of the information that the court ordered you to turn over, you have?
Yes, with the only exception that the 2.4, 2.5 are not really how ShotSpotter works, and so we would have to talk to...
So you could clarify that, say the information is not available, or however we normally respond to a subpoena that's not responsive.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Explain to me this thing about a reclassification.
Sure. There are instances, reclassification is a term of art for ShotSpotter. There are certain instances where, for example, if there are multiple gunshots that occur, the computer, which will then send the information to a human being to be listened to, may classify one of the first ones as something different, and therefore it doesn't get into the review. Does that make sense so far? Let me start again. When there's a noise that the computer believes is sounds like gunfire, it forwards that information to a human for review.
Right.
All right.
And without assessment.
It provides, it's algorithmic number, like it has 96.8%, which means essentially, and this is in the very grossest of terms, this has characteristics that I know to be gunfire. But that is
not the person. You mean the machine knows to be.
I'm sorry?
The machine knows to be. This is begins with the machine.
So machine is the 96%.
Artificial intelligence.
Correct.
Okay? Yes. All right. So
now
the machine is telling us this. All right.
No, the machine's not telling you. It goes to a human being within ShotSpotter.
How did it get to the human?
The machine forwards.
Okay, that's all I meant.
Okay, I thought.
So it gets to a human now. In this case, let's talk about this one case.
Yeah, sure.
There was one report.
Yes.
Okay, so go on.
And the person determines whether it's gunfire by listening to the audio wave and then forwards it along.
Right. But how does, my question was, tell us about reclassification.
I just wanted to lay the groundwork. So
yeah, I think we know that part. Okay. We understand that part.
If there are multiple gunfire, for example, that happens all at once, the machine may take some of that gunfire and move it over and say, that doesn't sound like gunfire. Let me forward this along to the reviewer. So, for example, if there were 6 shots in actuality, the machine may only forward 4 of those shots. The sensors get overwhelmed. Human reviewers, for example, the expert who now...
Wait, Mr. Berger, on each one of those shots, does it give that same assessment,
yes.
96,
yes.
72?
Yes.
Okay.
The human reviewer will go back to the audio file later on, after the alert, after... Whenever, for example, the defense counsel wants subpoenas or the state subpoenas, and they'll listen to all of the audio files related to that event. And they may reclassify in the event, in those singular events.
Okay, so that's really my question here. This is what I want to know. You just jumped from it just automatically, the human person in this scenario we just have, you're suggesting they didn't reclassify anything, right?
There wouldn't have been a reclassification in the real-time alert, yes.
Okay, so a reclassification only occurs when?
A reclassification would occur if there were an alert. After the alert goes out, the person is, whatever happens, somebody subpoenas the information from ShotSpotter. The forensic person will go through and listen to all of the gunfire that's associated with that event. And there are times when at least one of the gunfire was not caught by the sensor. It's all in the same event. It just wasn't caught.
Okay, but what I'm asking you is this. This only happens when somebody actually complains or suggests that...
No.
Okay, so then let's go back to the scenario that you've described. These sounds are indicated to the human that this is an alert that should go out.
Yes.
Right? Okay, so the person...
No, that's not
okay,
correct.
Well then explain it to me again.
Sure. The computer forwards the sound to a person.
Yeah.
The person makes a decision whether it's gunfire or not. If the
okay.
person says it's not gunfire, nothing happens.
All right, so the reclassification is always after the fact. It
that's
would never be
saying.
In the first instance.
That's exactly...
But a human could say that... And is it just a matter of listening?
Yes.
So the person that's doing this is simply listening and deciding whether or not that sounds like a gunshot to the person.
Absolutely.
When does the alert go to the police?
Immediately.
Immediately. So this analysis that's happening with the human may be well after the police have been dispatched.
For a reclassification, definitely.
Okay.
That happens afterward. And again, it doesn't mean that the gunfire didn't occur. It's usually in instances of multiple gunfire. So it's just picking up extra gunfire, not like it's reclassifying the entire
okay,
event.
Okay, so
it
you
was
know what?
Gunfire.
Now that you've mentioned this,
yes.
So would you suggest that the lawyers representing this particular person, that they would have absolutely no interest in knowing how the human person is listening and deciding and there's really, there's nothing that that person has as far as training to determine that the machine got it right because I listened to it now and now I agree it's
I
a gunshot?
I didn't suggest there was no training at all.
No, I know, and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That's what some of the things that they want. They want to know the protocols, the procedures that the human is doing so that human who's just gotten an alert, or whatever you want to call it, from the machine, that there's, it's a 99% chance this was gunfire, that that person now is going to determine whether it was or not.
I would never make that argument.
Well, I'm asking you. I'm saying, wouldn't the defense have a right to know how the human reviewed the machine? And isn't that what they're asking for in one of their requests?
If the defense actually brought a motion for anything, a motion to suppress, actually put it at issue.
Okay, so you're saying everything here is...
That's where we are...
You're saying everything here is premature.
That's what... Exactly.
Okay.
Because what I'm also saying is, those documents will frame out... You have never seen ShotSpotter here on an appeal. Those documents frame out... No,
what does that have to do with anything?
Because the documents, when they're filed, actually frame out, I can then argue or agree, this is definitely relevant.
Okay, so why didn't you raise this in your brief, that this is all premature?
I think we did say that.
I don't think you did. I think you're saying that the objective factors, that the police... I mean, you've raised a number of things, but you have never suggested... Well, I guess you have, because you said that the judge sort of suggested a theory about a motion to suppress.
That's exactly right.
Yes, in fact, Mr. Parker, didn't you say that the standard for what is relevant when subpoenaing records from a third party is different than when you are dealing with parties' discovery, right? You said that records have to be known to be relevant.
Yes.
And that differs from the position taken by the defense in this case, right?
And I'm not trying to be obstreperous and just say no. I understand how some of this information could be valuable. That's not my argument.
Okay, so then are you really saying that, are you now saying that the public defender, until they file a motion to suppress, you shouldn't have to turn over anything?
Because, yes, because it frames it out. I mean, listen, we had a trial record where page 5 of the trial record, the state said, ShotSpotter's not involved in this case at all. And I understand what the police report said. But that frames it in a way. I don't know which to take as true or not true at this point. I don't have a position on whether which is true or not true. I'm just saying if there's a motion to suppress, I actually then know what will be framed up.
What did the state's brief suggest that's been filed?
They said that it may be relevant to a Terry stop, but I don't know what that means.
You don't know what that means?
This is what I don't know what it means. I don't know if... Go on.
If there is a pretextual stop of someone, for whatever reason, wouldn't what goes into that stop be relevant to determine whether or not that arrest is quashed?
Yes.
So if there are false notifications of gunshots and there are people being stopped because of false notifications of gunshots, wouldn't that be relevant for them to know how reliable that system is?
So you're not going to like this question and answer it, Paul.
That doesn't matter. You go ahead. You're fighting your fight.
Technically, from the police point of view, unless the police knew it was a false alert, no, it wouldn't be relevant. That's just the true answer. We've actually cited cases like
that.
Well,
what case would you suggest?
Here, let me find the cases. And I told you wouldn't like the argument. It's not an argument that is very winning. It's at page 22 to 23 of our briefs. There are 5 cases cited. I didn't come lead with that argument because it's probably the least appealing of the arguments clearly that I'm making today.
I did criminal defense. I know least appealing arguments.
That is the true answer to the question. If they knew, and that's what the government said, and the defense says, we're in a different place altogether. And again, that's what I'm saying. Having actual papers that frame things out, it may be that we don't have to look for protocols from 1996. It may be that those are the things that the court below granted this, denied our motion to quash, at least in part, because one, the court said if the state makes it relevant, and the second was that there was a policy for police to stop people. And that was the second reason. That has not been defended on appeal because there is nothing in the record indicating the policy. And all I am really saying, once things are framed out, that's a whole different world. And you have not seen us, and it's relevant to me to say, you've not seen us up here fighting these things just left and right, because typically there is something framing out
But how could, as you know, lawyers have to have a basis in order to make allegations in any motion that's filed in court.
Yes.
How could they have a basis to argue that a ShotSpotter alert is not an appropriate basis for a Terry stop if they don't have the information?
I understand. Let me do it in a different way, and I don't mean to, I'm not trying to avoid your...
You're doing a good job. Keep going.
I'm sweating like this. Step one is, this is my world in which I live. And first, I'm told by the state's attorney, there is nothing, ShotSpotter has nothing to do with this case. They were driving on their way, and then they saw the guy. Not close, it was a block away from actually where the alert was. That's what I know.
Well, that's the position that they took during the hearing.
That's right.
Yes.
Now I'm told it's maybe relevant to a Terry stop, and Judge McBride chastised me when I said I don't know what that means. I know what a Terry stop
is. No, I know that you know what it means.
Yeah. So here's what, I don't know if it, that means their position has changed. So the story could be, we were on our way to a ShotSpotter alert and we saw this guy. Right? That doesn't make ShotSpotter very relevant at all any more than I was going to pick up my
laundry. Does if they say that due to the nature of the stop, they immediately ask the driver out of the vehicle to conduct a previously mentioned shots fired investigation.
So in other words, does the arrest report actually frame what is relevant to
I don't
you?
Know.
And not the fact that they were on their way and they were a block away. Does it even matter that they were a block away when they saw this guy?
But that's what I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the underlying fact enough to understand it.
Yeah.
That's all that, as a Nixon standard, that's what I'm asking for. And I think I'm right to do that. I think it's right to say, this was what helps us frame it out. Is there a delay? They could have filed this. We provided the information. They can now
file. You provided what you wanted to provide,
not
what you were ordered to provide, or what they sought. I mean, I don't know. I think this whole idea that because the state said they probably won't use this, I mean, that has nothing to do with the issue here. This wasn't a subpoena issued by the state. It was issued by the lawyers that are representing this person. And it would actually be ineffective of them if they didn't challenge the arrest. It happens in virtually every case if there's even a hint of something that is lacking in reasonable suspicion or probable cause. I mean, are you suggesting that, why don't you suggest to the trial judge that let's postpone this. This isn't ripe for review. You'd be giving an advisory opinion about this whole case. I mean, isn't that kind of what you're saying here? That because they haven't filed a motion to suppress or something, that this isn't relevant?
I'm saying it's not relevant. And
okay, but what case says that the public defender or the lawyer that's representing a client has to file a motion to suppress in order for you to be satisfied that something's relevant?
It's not whether I'm satisfied. It's whether or not the material sought is relevant and relevant to something, and it's an evidentiary. And this is not evidentiary at all.
You say known to be relevant,
yes.
Not just suspected.
Yes.
That's the standard you're applying for
yes.
relevancy. And, of course, their standard is entirely different, right?
Their standard is different, but we have cited two cases where you can't issue a subpoena in hopes of discovering information.
Okay, well, tell us about those cases then. Give us those cases.
To a third party.
To a third party. The first case is People versus Cannon, and I'm looking for the page which it cited.
And how does Cannon?
That was a, it was a case involving prosecutorial, a request to obtain evidence so that they could bring a selective prosecution motion. The other case is People
and
versus...
And how does that support your position?
Because the court said you can't just, if you have to have evidence, you can't just seek the evidence and say, I'm going to now build a case after that.
Okay. And you're saying there is no evidence here at all. That police report is meaningless.
I have never said anything like that.
Okay, well, is it or not?
That.
There's a police report on file that indicates three times that the reason we stopped him was because of a gunshot alert.
Yes, but the police are not lawyers. They're not trying this case. I don't know
right.
the
how
relationship
between... Right, how could they even opine about ShotSpotter?
I'm sorry?
I don't know how that these officers, which you suggest, you know, are the ones that can talk about this, when There's no case in Illinois where any officer has testified to this reliability.
Mr. Parker, does it change your analysis at all that the defendant in this case was not arrested for a gun?
Yeah. I mean, when we heard that not only was he not arrested for a gun, but they weren't even, the state said that he wasn't arrested because of the shot. He was arrested as they were passing him by. Then the ShotSpotter alert has actually no relevance in my view at all. Those two together are important. If there were a ShotSpotter alert and then he was arrested for DUI at that time, maybe it would have been relevant if there was a motion to suppress brought. And, you know, you claim it was pretextual. Those type of arguments I totally understand. All right? I don't even know if I want to come back up.
What about the general idea that the officers heard that there was a gunshot at this 244, whatever, West, I forget the name of the street. And they see a car.
Yeah.
But they don't ever testify that anything that had to do with a gun, when they went to the car. There was nothing that would have suggested to them, other than the gunshot alert, that brought them to the car. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure which part I was supposed to agree with.
The report says that they responded to a gunshot alert at a location.
Yes, I agree.
On their way there, they saw someone in a car.
Yes.
Okay, well, what else did they see, or you don't know?
Presumably, didn't they see a lot of people in cars on their way there?
Yeah.
But wasn't it this U-turn situation?
This is,
and
yeah, I
what
mean,
they like, thought was evading the police?
Yeah, if you want it, that's if you want what I understand, that's what I understand. And I also understand that there are instances, and we cite the cases, for example, where, you know, the police show up in an area for one reason. They get a 911 call, there's a murder, and they arrest somebody for drunk driving or something completely different. The 911 call falls out of that equation altogether. And in this instance, ShotSpotter could easily fall outside of the equation. And you're asking me, what does the police report say? I know what it says. I don't know what the police will actually testify. And if there were a motion to suppress, then the state would be put to the test of whether or not the police would testify either consistent with the police report.
No, actually,
or
the burden
different.
Would start with the defense, okay? So this is all about the defense case. I do think you're kind of like conflating.
I am not. I am
horrible. Well, you're saying that the state has the burden to put on evidence that this arrest was proper. Actually, the burden wouldn't start there. It starts with the defense. That's really what's going on here.
But they can file a motion to suppress based upon
the
police.
Right, and you're basically saying that the court should not do anything because a motion to suppress wasn't filed.
There's nothing framed making this material sought evidentiary.
And that's like saying that until the defense files a motion to suppress, they have no business getting ready to defend their client because it's not their job, when in fact it truly is their job to prepare a defense. And it's obvious from the arrest report, any lawyer out of the first year out of criminal law would challenge this particular stop. So to say it's not relevant doesn't really hold water.
I'm saying then they should have, and then I would know precisely what I'm responding to and why precisely, and the court could actually precisely say
why.
Well,
I don't think you
well.
Cited a single case that suggests what you're suggesting. I don't think there's a single case here that suggests that the defense can't pursue a defense before trial because a third party doesn't want to bring forth or be obligated to present anything relevant to the system that brought the police to the place where they were. And I think the judge tried to balance the interests of the third party with the fundamental right of the defense in this case. That's really what this is about. It's not about the state's attorney's office, I don't think. So I think that you're suggesting everything is just premature and maybe you'll do it later or would like to do it later.
It's not about whether, I mean, the court has framed it in that way, like or not like.
Well, did the judge frame it that way, too?
No.
It's not
whether
you
like or don't like it.
About a policy or something?
I'm only pushing back on this. It's not whether we like or don't like producing information or want or not want. It is whether or not we have a legal obligation to do so.
Well, let's go back just briefly. You did criticize the judge for suggesting that there was a policy, right? Maybe the police have a policy of responding.
I did not criticize the judge, but I did note that that was one of the bases, and it was not. It's not supported by the record, nor is it defended by the public.
And why isn't it supported by the record?
There's nothing to indicate.
Do you have a contract with the City of Chicago Police Department?
Yes.
And under that contract, do you have to provide these alerts because they pay for you to provide them to them?
We provide the alerts to the City of Chicago. Yes.
Okay.
But there is no policy that police are required to stop anyone.
That you know of.
What's that?
That you know of. That would be
that's correct.
The Chicago Police Department and not Chicago.
And that was precisely my argument as well, which is no amount of discovery for us would help on that at all. And none of the discovery here actually does.
Well, you'll have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Packer.
I'm looking forward to it.
Edelman, you may proceed.
You ready?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Celeste Edelman. I'm an assistant public defender. I represent the appellee in this case, Mr. Merritt Jones.
Ms. Edelman, was there a protective order entered?
Judge Howard indicated over our objection that she would be entering a protective order. The actual order was not entered yet, but she did indicate that she would, and we expected that to have happened had those documents been provided to us.
Okay. Well, usually a protective order is entered before the documents have to be provided.
That is true. We expected that when we came back to court on July 22nd of 2022 that Judge Howard would enter that protective order and we would be provided with those materials. As it happens, ShotSpotter took a different tack and we have never received those items. So there is no protective order in place.
Do you agree that the protocols requested would go back 25 years?
No, Judge, I don't. ShotSpotter misquoted our subpoena requests in their briefing, both below and before the court here. If you go back and look at the actual subpoena, every one of those requests specifies that we're talking about the particular alert in this case, which is identified that there's a Flex ID number. So we're asking for...
You said that in your brief, didn't you?
That
it was specific to this one request and this one report.
That's correct.
So what was the protocol in effect at that time that this report was generated?
That's correct. If it's available to the analyst, it's available to be produced to us.
And that is the order that Judge Howard entered as well.
Yes.
Limiting the protocols to that one incident.
She ordered that the subpoena be enforced, and that's what the language of the subpoena was, that it would only be as to the specific alert.
Okay, with regard to the 3 months prior and three months post incident for the reclassification, that is citywide, correct?
Yes, so we're seeking reclassification notices, and actually, ShotSpotter and their argument kind of conflated some of the requests we're making, because there's actually two data sets that we're looking at. One is the reclassification notices that when the human reviewer disagrees with the machine algorithm at the time that the alert is pushed to the Chicago Police Department. So that's one set of data that we're looking for that Judge Howard did after hearing arguments.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. The alert goes out immediately to the Chicago Police Department. The reclassification doesn't occur until much, much later. So you're looking for any time the alert goes out and it's later reclassified?
So there's two sets of when the determination might change. There's two times when the determination might change, and we're looking for both of them. And as Mr. Parker noted, reclassification is a term of art that they use, but very simply, what we're looking for, and actually we didn't... very simply, what we're looking for is any time when that initial alert goes from the machine to the operator in ShotSpotter's the human ShotSpotter operator. We're looking for any time that ShotSpotter operator disagreed with that initial machine classification.
And so what is the time frame usually? Do you have any idea?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the question.
What's the time frame? The alert goes out, the reclassification that goes to the human who reclassifies it. Are we talking minutes? Are we talking days? Are we talking weeks? What are we talking?
It happens very quickly. So on the, one of the things that we do know from the discovery that was provided us, the four-page document, is it does show when the alert was pushed from the machine to the human operator. It takes place typically under a minute.
Okay.
Yes. And so then there's a second.
Does that impact, I'm sorry to interrupt you, does that impact the alert? Let's say the alert goes out, it goes to the human within minutes, human says, no, it's not gunfire. Does that cancel the alert or does that impact it? Do we know?
I don't know because if there was no alert, I wouldn't get it. And Mr. Jones would never have been arrested and I would never be here arguing to you this morning.
Got it.
Yes.
Thank
you. Every day in the city of Chicago, the Chicago Police Department sends out their officers in response to these alerts. They do this knowing that only 9.1% of these alerts...
Well, how are you getting to that now?
That number, Judge?
Yeah.
That's from the Office of the Inspector General's
report.
No,
I know, but you just equated the Office of the Inspector General's knowledge to all the police officers that are out there.
So the city of Chicago Inspector General, one, we know from the report they're using the Chicago Police Department's own data. That is a report of a governmental agency that is admissible in court under Rule 803A. It's a report of a governmental agency. That report is generated based on data that was from the Chicago Police Department and is known to the Chicago Police Department. So this time, maybe there was a question prior to 2021 as to whether or not the Chicago Police Department as a whole knew how effective this system was.
I have a question. So this alert came out at 10:15 a.m. and the police see defendant's vehicle at 10:30, 15 minutes later. Is that relevant to your inquiry at all?
Absolutely.
I mean, if somebody's shooting a gun, they're not going to hang out for 15 minutes is my point.
Sure.
So couldn't that be also impacting this 9% reliability rate if it takes 15 minutes?
It absolutely could, Judge. And, you know, as the court knows, our determination of reasonable articulable suspicion or probable cause is a fact-centered determination. It's the totality of the circumstances. But what I think we can take from the OIG's report is that we know this is a system that doesn't have a very high accuracy rate. We know from our previous subpoena responses in this case that ShotSpotter has never conducted any actual validation testing or live fire testing of this system in Chicago. They have no error rate to proffer to us specifically about the city of Chicago, which is important because we're not just talking about a system that's being used nationwide. We're talking about a system that's governed by sound waves and impediments to sound waves, and so the particular landscape that it exists in, that is important and would affect an error rate. So what we're trying to get at here is we know that there's some kind of issue, we know this from the publicly available data, and we're trying to dig, and that is what gives us the reason, the materiality, to dig into this a little bit deeper. And because they haven't assembled the scientifically robust testing that we would expect of a forensic method, this is what we have to do to try to get at what that error rate is and how reliable is the system.
So you decided to use this case to basically develop a system for challenging later cases? That's almost what it sounds like.
No, Justice, this... How am I going to, in this case, if I'm going to file a motion to suppress Mr. Jones's arrest, I have to be able to give the trial court some kind of indication about whether or not the system actually works. And so, no, this is absolutely...
Well, this isn't the first time the public defender's office has tried to get information from ShotSpotter, is it?
No, it's not, Judge. Yes.
I mean, multiple times.
Yes.
There have been requests, some judges have ruled, usually maybe against, I don't know, there's something in the record. But this is not like the first rodeo, so to speak. For you trying to get information for a motion to suppress that in all likelihood you're going to file on this case.
Yes, and we have and do file motions to suppress on ShotSpotter cases.
I'm sorry, what did you just say?
We have and do and will file motions to suppress on ShotSpotter cases.
Ms. Edmund, how does this change? I have a couple different questions here. Okay, how does it change that, one, he wasn't arrested for any gunfire? Does that change your necessity? So it's more akin to they get an anonymous tip that, you know, somebody's doing something, they go to that area and they find something completely different that has nothing to do with their anonymous tip. Why isn't it like that situation?
So one, well, the first thing just off the top that we can think about is the fact that Mr. Jones is arrested with no evidence of having fired a gunshot. That immediately calls into whatever this supposed shots fired investigation was, calls that into question.
But why does that, I think the argument that the state would make is it's completely irrelevant what brought the police to the area. They then see a crime committed, and I know the state's pivoted off of the arrest report, now saying shots fired has nothing to do with it. But doesn't that mean something to us? Does that mean that every single time they arrest somebody for something else, they have to justify why they're in the area?
Well, I think what we can, in this case, we can look at the specific facts of this case, which are there were 6 traffic tickets that were issued to Mr. Jones. Every single one of those tickets was not for any traffic offense that was observed prior to his stop and seizure by the police department.
What about the U-turn and parked and blocking the park?
Well, 2 things, Your Honor. One, a U-turn is not necessarily illegal, and nowhere in this record has it been demonstrated or proven or shown that that was an illegal U-turn. Second, the blocking
of... Why did they include it in the report then at some point? They said that he was blocking the park, and then he made a U-turn, so then they stopped him.
Judge, I can't pretend that I'm in the head of a Chicago police officer, that he included that for whatever reasons known only to himself.
Do you think this motorist would have been stopped without those things? Without blocking the park entrance and without making the U-turn and seemingly evading the police by getting out of there and going a different way?
Well, evading the police is not a term that's used in the arrest report to the best of my recollection. We can also look at the fact that there was no citation ever issued for this U-turn, and I think certainly if this was an illegal U-turn or there was some kind of evasion going on, fleeing and eluding is certainly a charge.
Well, they say in the report, the one that's really in the record right now before us actually mentions 3 times that they first went to his car because of the alert. Then in the middle of the report, it says that they observed something. Then they said a second time they were acting on the report of the gunshot. And then they conclude with the same notion that this was as a result of the shot spotter report of a gunfire shot.
That's correct. And I don't think at any point this pivoted from a shots fired investigation to an investigation of an illegal U-turn or blocking the driveway. And I do want to address the blocking of the driveway because that appears nowhere else in the record aside from the state's sort of off-the-cuff proffer. We don't know where that came from. We don't know what statute or ordinance that's supposed to have violated. That's just sort of the state's off-the-cuff representation in response to the trial courts asking them for that information. And
why are you entitled to this now? There's been some suggestion that this is like premature or that we'd be giving an advisory opinion or that the judge should have no business actually honoring this subpoena duties hecum in this case because there's really no issue. Nothing's been framed.
So we can't excise or delete the fact of the ShotSpotter alert in this case. A ShotSpotter alert happened. It was part of the mix there. It's mentioned 3 times in the arrest report. It's incumbent on us as defense counsel to investigate anything that seems relevant to Mr. Jones' defense. It certainly seems at this point that it's going to be relevant to a motion to suppress. And also, as the state concedes in their brief, it may also be relevant to a course of conduct evidence. So that is... We can't wait till the moment when we file the motion to suppress or the moment when we get to trial, because then when we get to trial or the motion to suppress, all of a sudden an issue comes up about the reliability of ShotSpotter, and oh wait, I should have subpoenaed those documents before, but I can't, so I didn't, and now I'm stuck without doing that. There's no authority that says that we have to wait until something is on file. Certainly it's incumbent upon us to subject the state's case to meaningful adversarial testing.
Well, when does that start? Does that start 6 months from now, or did that start when those lawyers were appointed to represent the defendant?
You know
the answer. The responsibility to defend begins the moment that the attorney is appointed to represent his or her client.
Absolutely. And we issued these subpoenas. Mr. Jones was arrested on this matter in November of 2021. We issued these subpoenas in February of 2022. There was no delay here, which is one of the Nixon factors. We jumped on this right away, and we have made it an issue. And there's been no delay occasioned by us. The delay has been occasioned by the other parties.
Is there any evidence in the record that the public defender's office is also questioning the reliability in general and wants that this system of testing be put to the test under fraud?
I think, so whether, what significance Frye has to a Fourth Amendment issue is not super clear. But what we do know is there are no published decisions in Illinois which regarding the Frye, whether or not this system meets the Frye standard for general acceptance in the scientific community. We know that. We know that there have not been any Frye hearings in Illinois that test this system. And again, Mr. Parker points out that there have been hearings in other states, but we're talking about a system that is Chicago-specific and installed in Chicago specifically, which would be definitely an area of inquiry. So I think that one of the things the court can consider, regardless of whether or not Frye comes into play in a Fourth Amendment context, is that there's nothing for you to rely on in terms of a Frye decision. There's nothing for you to take judicial notice of the fact that it is generally accepted. And we would submit, our position would be that it's not. Our position would be that it does not meet Frye and that it does not meet general acceptance.
Could you just summarize, too, just very briefly, what the Inspector General's report actually says about this system?
The Inspector General's report essentially boils down to that this system very rarely comes up with actual evidence of a gun-related crime. That's 9.1% of cases. And that it is used and relied upon by the Chicago Police Department to effectuate arrests, believing that it is evidence of gunfire. I think the thing that can be seen from this record is the Chicago Police Department does believe that this is evidence of gunshots, because certainly that's how the officers react. That's how the officer in this case reacted to that ShotSpotter alert. That officer says, I'm investigating a shots fired related incident. So they are seeing and they are treating these alerts as actual evidence of gunfire, as reliable evidence of gunfire, and the record's simply not there to support that.
But you're not saying that it's reliable evidence of gunfire. You're saying that it didn't result in the arrest. And like Justice Burke mentioned a little while ago, people leave within 15 minutes or whatever the response time is for the police with their gun. So obviously it wouldn't result in an arrest very often.
And that could be what comes out at the factual circumstances in this motion. However, if it turns out that there is a different set of facts that somehow ShotSpotter is relevant to this stop and this defense, then I need those documents before I file that motion. I need those documents before I proceed upon that motion or I waive that. And I think that's one of the things that we see in many of the Fourth Amendment cases that have been cited here by ShotSpotter and also by us. None of these cases talk about a very robust reliability challenge to ShotSpotter. And in fact, United States versus Rickman, the Seventh Circuit case, they even directly say that the defendant in that case gave up and didn't ever fully make their record about...
Isn't that the case where they say that standing alone, that would never amount to any reason for the police to stop anything?
Absolutely, and I think that's also something the court can consider here.
I want to take you back to relevancy for a second. So you seem to use materiality interchangeably with relevancy in your brief. And I want to know if there's a difference. And also, you articulate a different standard than the one ShotSpotter used for determining relevancy when subpoenaing records from a third party. They say records have to be known to be relevant, not just suspected to be relevant. What do you say to that? This whole standard of what defines relevancy for us?
So the first thing I'll say is that People versus Sauls, which is the recent Illinois Supreme Court case, specifically says materiality is not a different standard. Materiality encompasses the Nixon factors. It's not a different standard. It's the same standard. It encompasses Nixon and it encompasses some other cases that go along with it, which are also cited in our brief. If you look at the Nixon case itself, because I copied and pasted my notes from it the other day, there's no, you used the word that it must be evidentiary or known to be evidentiary and relevant. That known to be is not in Nixon. The prong, the language of Nixon just says that the documents are evidentiary and relevant.
Oh, so the known was actually put in by some other court.
Yes, at some point. I'm not sure when that got added, but that's not what the language is in Nixon.
So no citation to the authority.
I'm sorry, did that answer your question?
You answered my question, and then my colleague asked you another question.
You can continue.
Sure.
So, oh, yeah, every one of your requests was actually, it specified this particular report, didn't it? Weren't your, all of your seven?
All, yes, all of the requests in the, in this, the ones that are numbered, the seven series, those were all limited to the alerts in this case. Some of the other subpoena requests were not, such as, like, the reclassification notices, because those seek a wider data set. But, yes, certainly all of the seven were limited in that fashion. Another point on, so materiality, which we know is, again, encompasses Nixon, but adds some more. We also know that, that Illinois case law contemplates that it's not just what may be admissible at trial, it's also what is, leads to what is admissible. That's People v. Cletus. And it's a very low showing. We're talking at this point, again, the court has a very meager record here, a very sparse record, because we haven't gone, which is very unusual in a criminal case. Normally, we're not before you at this point talking about this. And so the standard post-conviction in order to get a reversal of that conviction is much higher with materiality. You have to, there's like a, almost a Brady showing that has to be made in terms of that it would have changed the outcome of the trial. Here we're talking about, we are pretrial. It's a very low burden. We have shown that it's relevant and reliable. And the point that ShotSpotter makes that there should be some difference between what is available in discovery between the parties and what is available from a third party, there's no authority cited for that, first and foremost. And second, it just, it begs an absurd result. Because if a defendant is entitled to information, if we can make a showing that it's relevant and evidentiary to our case and it's necessary to prepare our side of the case for trial, it shouldn't matter where it comes from. If we're entitled to it, we're entitled to it.
So you're saying it doesn't really matter if you try to get it from the police who really don't have this actual information, or the third party who does?
Correct.
You think the same standard of relevancy applies?
Yes, I do. And I also agree with Mr. Parker insofar that this is an insufficient record. We are premature in deciding whether what significance a ShotSpotter alert should play under the Fourth Amendment. This court would be in a much better position to, for after I've received all these documents, after I have been able to put on a full and complete motion to suppress, presented that record about reliability of the system. Once all of that has been done, this court would be in a much better position to decide what, if any, on a case of first impression for Illinois courts, what, if any, significance these alerts should have. And that's part of the trouble, I think, for the court at this point, is that this is really just a bunch of conjecture. We're relying on an offhand comment from the state's attorney, just an arrest report. There's clearly a lot of other evidence in this case, witnesses that will testify, body-worn camera. This court would be much better equipped to make a full and considered ruling as to that significance once we've been able to present all of that. And these documents are necessary for us to be able to do that.
Anything further you want to add at this time?
Judge, we're asking you to affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Okay, and just so we're going to be clear when we ask Parker about the question about the request in number seven, you're saying that the suggestion that he has made in his brief is not an accurate description of what you requested. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we'll let Mr. Parker explain that one to us.
Sure. You won't have to do this, but I want to give you the page reference.
Okay.
It's appendix page 265 that has all the sevens. The first 7.1 is explicitly limited to November 7th, 2021. The remainder have no date restriction at all. I'll gladly accept a date restriction, but they don't have
any. Does it have the report number?
It does. It starts with guarding, and it gives me a flex number, and then it says all of the remainder of the request. The problem I have is the first one has a date limitation and the remainder do not. And so just sort of statutory interpretation, when one has a date limitation and the remainder don't, I'm assuming that is a purposeful decision to exclude the date. Mm-hmm. If the limitation is to November 7th, I still object to this, of course, but I'll accept it. But that's not what the court said, and it's not how I read this subpoena.
Okay, but it does. Every single request for 7th refers to Flex ID.
I agree with you.
Pound 872-523-762.
I'm not fussing with the court at all. I'm just saying.
But you're saying because they limited the first 7.1.
Correct.
From on or about November 7th, and that we should use statutory interpretation to interpret that.
I'm not saying you should. I'm saying that's why I made the argument I made. I think it's a good faith argument. And I'm being told not to read it that way, and I'll gladly not read it that way.
Okay.
But my argument was not incorrect, given the way it's written.
Okay. All right, well, what do you want to say in rebuttal? We're going to give you some time.
Sure.
Just let you talk.
Sure. I'm going to just be brief, but I would say that the argument that this is all conjecture, that somehow they need to be developed, and we're not even sure how the Fourth Amendment plays into the reliability on ShotSpotter. That has nothing to do with ShotSpotter reliability. That's the Fourth Amendment cases. We cite them already that you don't need to challenge reliability, including United States versus Rickman. But the whole argument about conjecture is precisely why I've asked that this be framed out more solidly and completely, that they can bring the argument that they want, and then it can develop. Next, OIG report. It's actually a misstatement to say that ShotSpotter is unreliable. It found that there were arrests, the number of arrests and evidence found after ShotSpotter report, after ShotSpotter alert is low. It did not impugn the reliability of ShotSpotter. There are many reasons why you might not make an arrest. And, for example, people don't stick around or the response time is delayed. It does not mean that ShotSpotter causes people to be arrested, directs the police to be arrested, and there is no evidence in the record that that is so. Finally, reclassification. It's important because if you write an opinion where I lose, that's fine, but it is not considered it's not defined as reclassification when there's an alert, when it goes from the machine, the person listens to the noise and then sends the alert to the police. It's not withdrawn ever. It happens after.
How long is your normal time frame between the sound that says this is a 99% chance it's a gunshot, then the human reviews it? How much?
Within a minute.
Within a minute? And then how soon after that does it go to the police department?
Immediately. I believe in Chicago it goes to a particular center that then forwards it to the police.
All right.
But that's just.
So yeah. Again, it's possible for the human not to send it to the police?
Oh, they do all the time.
So they say, oh, no, that sounded like a firework.
Correct. And that's not considered a reclassification.
That's not reclassification.
It's just what they do.
It doesn't go.
It's like water to a fish.
Why do they need a human to tell the machine, well, this is really a firecracker?
Because I don't think they want to just rely on an algorithm. They
humans
don't want to rely on
artificial
intelligence. Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Humans are stronger than the artificial intelligence that humans created.
In this instance, yes.
How would you describe ShotSpotter? Is it a reliable, like, informant, or is this really an anonymous tip? It doesn't matter. For under the law.
The Seventh Circuit calls it an anonymous tip.
And what about the rest of the circuits?
I don't think any of the circuits, the Second Circuit has dealt with it in terms of having a person testify about its reliability as an anonymous tip. Right.
Are you familiar with those cases about what happens when you get an anonymous tip? What the police are supposed to do?
They're supposed to testify as to its reliability or not.
Right. And how do they normally do that?
They testify about their own personal experience.
I think we're going to disagree about that one.
They testify about their own personal experience with that anonymous tipster is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's what people are doing in these
cases.
Normally,
if it's an anonymous tip, there has to be something that the police officer sees when he gets there that suggests that this isn't just nothing. So, anyway, you're suggesting or you agree that at least the Seventh Circuit has referred to this ShotSpotter is like an anonymous tipster.
I couldn't disagree because that's exactly what they say.
Yeah, okay. All right. Anything further by Anna?
All right, well, thank you.
This was a very well-argued, well-briefed case. We will take it under advisement, and we're going to have to switch panels for our next oral.